From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, Planet X. First of all, thank you for the amazing outpouring of birthday greetings. Wow. I'm truly taken by all of it. If you don't get a return thank you, I'll try. You'll understand it may take a few days. But thank you. Really appreciate it. Off to another year. Here's what's happening. More than 430 tiny temblors have rattled Southern California in the past 10 days or so. 430. Some just strong enough to be felt by residents. But the swarm of earthquakes hitting the Inland Empire, stretching from eastern Los Angeles to the Mojave Desert, probably doesn't indicate, they say, a major quake is on its way. At least not yet. In Florida, a former Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High resource officer, Scott Peterson, 56 years old, has been arrested on charges relating to failure to enter the school during a mass shooting there. He was charged in Broward County with 7 counts of neglect of a child, 3 counts of culpable negligence, and 1 of perjury after a 15-month investigation. The charges carry a combined potential prison sentence of nearly 100 years for the officer, blasted by many critics as the coward of Broward. His bail has been set at $102,000. Once released, Peterson will be required to wear a GPS monitor, surrender his passport, will be prohibited from possessing a firearm. The Florida Department of Law Enforcement investigation shows that the former Deputy Peterson did absolutely nothing to mitigate the shooting that killed 17 children, teachers and staff, and injured 17 others. They say there can be no excuse for his complete inaction and no question that his inaction cost lives. Let's go to Dr. John Curtis, onlinecolumnist.com. John, all this may be true, but can you put a guy in jail for being a coward?
Well, it's a good point. I mean, I don't know how the child neglect charges can be prosecuted with any kind of seriousness. I mean, certainly was a custodial parent or any kind of guardian of these kids. I mean, it's true that he was entirely incompetent and probably, you know, he did, they say, perjure himself when he said he heard no shots fired, which they disputed. So that perjury charge could stick. And I think, you know, the idea of some kind of negligence, dereliction of duty, he was a armed county sheriff, Broward County sheriff, on the site of that high school, and potentially could have neutralized Nicholas Cruz, who absolutely was ballistic. And this was the worst school shooting since Columbine in the United States. 17 killed, you know, with a few staff in there, mostly teenagers. Absolutely horrific. And I think what it raises is the issue that people are grappling with, even, you know, just more recently, with these shootings that are taking place with way too much regularity, is what's the motive behind somebody who is going ballistic, taking taking these firearms and basically discharging them into innocent civilians? And I think the most recent one, I think it really just opens the eyes of people to realize that law enforcement can only do so much given current gun laws. There's not much that anybody can do when you have 350 million guns circulating in the United States, getting into the hands of people who are, you know, on the verge of a breakdown, potentially, taking these actions completely out of control. So the question of how do you intercept this, how do you stop this before it happens, and now you've got a law enforcement officer here who's become a major scapegoat in the process, because the parents are absolutely furious that law enforcement did nothing. Their children were massacred and may have survived had he taken more, you know, forceful action. But I think that in the, you know, that at some point we're going to have to take inventory as a nation of what we're going to do about so many guns in circulation and so many people who are ill-equipped to possess those firearms.
But do you think, John, in this case, the fact that his penalty is he has to live with this for the rest of his life, to know that he was, you know, negligent in doing anything? But, I mean, I just don't know how you can put somebody in jail for being a coward, for panicking, for not doing what he's supposed to do.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I think, you know, maybe you can get him on dereliction of duty or some kind of negligence. But I think the child neglect issue is a bit of a stretch, and I don't think they'll be able to get him for that. But, you know, living with this is an incredible, you know, onus, a burden that will never go away.
No, this is a guy who could probably kill himself over this.
Oh, yeah, I would think so.
All right, John, thanks. John's online columnist at .com. An Iowa man died over the weekend after police say he was fatally injured, saving the life of his 5-year-old daughter, who was being mauled by a dog. Deputies with the Lee County Sheriff's Office were called to a Fort Madison home near the old Iowa State Prison around 10:31 in the morning, reports of a dog attack. Once at the residence, authorities saw a large dog attacking the 33-year-old man who was lying on his back in the front yard. The dog, whose breed was not identified by authorities, was said to be so aggressive it would not release the victim. Deputies were forced to shoot the dog in order to stop the attack. My gosh. Meanwhile, though, a new Israeli study has discovered that the blood pressure of children who were raised with a dog in the house were lower than children who were raised without one. It is widely known that having an animal in the house can greatly reduce stress and anxiety among pet owners and can even lead to a longer life. In fact, some doctors even prescribe therapy dogs or recommend that a patient adopt an animal if their anxiety or depression is severe enough as opposed to normal medications. Dr. Peter Bregan, our resident psychiatrist and author of Medication Madness, I would guess you would agree with that, Peter.
Oh, 100%. I mean, all the studies that show longevity and greater health and all are just touching on the edges of what's really going on with humans and dogs, which is that dogs bring out the best in human beings. I mean, they give us companionship, they give us comfort, they give us security, sometimes actually defend us, unlike the dog in the other story. And they give us joy and love. I mean, our dogs get joyful over us. They make us feel valuable. They do all the things that human beings need to do for each other. And I suspect, you know, there's been a theory for a while that dogs may have helped us evolve, that they may have coming into our evolution rather recently, 20,000 years ago or so, that they may have really taught us about trust, taught us about devotion, taught us even about unconditional love, because that's certainly what many, many people get from their dogs. So I would say, George, if those who don't have a dog and those who do, don't be shy about seeing that dog as giving you a great deal of the important spiritual aspects that there are to living, and you're giving it right back to your dog, and I think there's very important relationships.
And lower blood pressure to boot.
And lower blood pressure, and help you physically because you get more exercise.
You got it, Peter. Thank you. General Motors is working on revolutionary airless tires. They're working with Michelin to develop a non-pneumatic wheel and tire combination for use on its production cars and trucks. Wouldn't that be something? No more blowouts. How about that? Antibiotic resistance is one of the biggest public health challenges of our time. Each year in the U.S., at least 2 million people get an antibiotic-resistant infection. At least 23,000 people die. Fighting this threat is a public health priority that requires a collaborative global approach across all sectors. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, working to combat this threat, Up next, Dr. Matt McCarthy joins us. His latest work, Superbugs, The Race to Stop an Epidemic. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Dr. Matt McCarthy with us, an assistant professor of medicine at Weill Cornell and a staff physician at the New York Presbyterian Hospital. He serves on the ethics committee as well. His work has appeared in Sports Illustrated, Slate, the New England Journal of Medicine, Deadspin. His reviews for nonfiction for USA Today and its editor-in-chief of the current Fungal Infection Report. And, of course, his latest work is called Superbugs, The Race to Stop an Epidemic, came out just a few weeks ago. And we're talking about antibiotic resistance. It's one of the biggest public health challenges of our time. I didn't realize, Matt, until I started looking at your book and everything else, how bad this situation really is.
Oh, boy. Well, thanks for having me. This is what's going to be eating up a lot of conversation moving forward. It's going to be one of the biggest medical issues we have to confront of the next 10, 15 years.
When we talk about a superbug, what is that exactly?
Yeah, superbugs are drug-resistant microbes. That includes bacteria, fungi, parasites, and even viruses. And any one of those pathogens in our environment, when they become resistant to the treatments that we usually use, we call them a superbug. And we've been seeing more and more superbugs popping up. And what I've been focusing my career on is how do we treat them.
If we looked at them under a microscope, Doc, how would they look?
They look just like every other virus and fungus. You can't tell that it's a superbug by looking at it under a microscope. You know, we didn't even realize that this was a problem until really the 1990s when we finally had sophisticated equipment to detect the gene mutations that were allowing these microbes to evolve in a way that they could evade the treatments that we had. And our best antibiotics, we find, aren't working as well as they used to. And it's because the bacteria and the fungi are outsmarting us.
Interesting. We'll talk about that in a second. But antibiotics do not work on viruses, though, do they?
Good point. They do not. So we have antiviral medication. So if you get influenza, we would not give you an antibiotic, we would give you a drug called Tamiflu, which is an antiviral.
What's the difference between an antibiotic and an antiviral?
Well, antibiotic is for bacteria, and antiviral is for virus, and antifungal is for a fungal infection. So they each have a different subset of pathogens that they can be used for. But big picture here is that an antibiotic is to treat a bacterial infection.
If you think of an insect as a living being, obviously a critter, would the bacteria and the viruses be categorized almost the same thing? I mean, do they eat and breathe and do everything else that anything living does?
That's a great question. They don't quite do all of the functions that a little critter can do, but we're learning more and more about the remarkable things that these microscopic organisms can do. And I'll give you two examples that I talk about in my book. Is that the bacteria have developed these things called efflux pumps, which are microscopic vacuum cleaners, which can suck up any antibiotic that we give them and spit it out.
Jeez.
And the other thing that they can do is they've developed these enzymes where we give an antibiotic to a bacteria, and that bacteria can chop it up faster than we can pump it in. And so what has happened is that we've used antibiotics inappropriately for the last 30 or 40 years, and that has exposed these organisms to our treasure trove of antibiotics, and they've figured out ways to outmaneuver them and to destroy the drugs that we've relied on for so long.
I can't remember when I had an antibiotic, but when I did years ago, I always remember the doctor saying, take them all. Everything I prescribe, this little bottle, take them all. Don't stop at two or three, take them all. Why would he say that?
You nailed it. Well, This is a big question that people ask me is, why did we end up with all these superbugs? And part of it is that doctors have overprescribed them. Part of it is that patients haven't taken the drugs as directed. And I'll give you an example. If you were prescribed an antibiotic for 7 days and you only take it for 2 days, you're not going to kill all of the bacteria. And in fact, you're going to just expose them to the drug just enough that they can sense it, they can see what it's made of, and they can figure out ways to evolve around it. and to mutate so that they can survive in the presence of the drug. So if a doctor recommends 10 days of an antibiotic, you're supposed to take all 10 days so that you wipe out that superbug completely. And we've failed to communicate that to patients effectively. And that's something that I've been working a lot on, is just explaining why we prescribe things for the duration that we do and why it's important to follow those directions.
Because people get to a point, doctor, where they start feeling better and they figured, okay, the antibiotics kicked in, I don't have to take any more. And then this virus or this bacteria comes roaring back.
Exactly right. And I'll tell you, I'm a physician, but I'm also a patient. And I've had that feeling where, you know, a couple days in, I say, I'm feeling better. I don't know if I really have to take this. And, you know, it's really important to follow the directions as prescribed, because, again, the bacteria and the fungi are constantly evolving. And if we don't wipe them out with the full course of treatment, they will survive, and they're going to come back stronger and more difficult to treat the next time around.
We're with Dr. Matt McCarthy. His latest book is called Superbugs, The Race to Stop an Epidemic. He's got a couple other books out there. One is called Odd Man Out. The other is The Real Doctor. We'll see you shortly. Odd Man Out, is that about a baseball team?
That's about my year in minor league baseball.
That's what I thought.
I went to Yale, and I was a molecular biophysics major, but I was also a left-handed pitcher. And I got drafted and played a year of minor league baseball. And so it was a look at what's it like to be you spend your whole life dreaming of playing professional sports. You get drafted, you show up, and you realize you're just not that good.
Did you, not to digress here, but did you know how to throw a knuckleball with your left arm?
I threw a knuckleball. I was a lefty who could throw a pretty good curveball. But I ran into the likes of guys like Prince Fielder, who could hit the ball 400 feet off of me.
Yep.
And let's just say that's why I ended up trading the baseball mitt for a stethoscope.
Amazing. I know his father played for the Detroit Tigers.
Yeah, absolutely. His father would be at the games.
I actually wanted to be, when I was younger, a pitcher. I was fascinated by Hoyt Wilhelm, who used to play for the Baltimore Orioles.
Oh, yeah.
And he was this great knuckleball pitcher. So that's what I tried to play and perfect and everything. And then I was going to go call up the Detroit Tigers and say, try me out. I just want to throw this one pitch, and if your guys can't hit it, sign me up. Except I couldn't get it over the plate.
Yeah, well, knuckleballers can play for a long time, so you are thinking the right way.
They sure can. Anyways, let me ask you about an infection that I hear so much about these days. And it's called sepsis. What the heck is this?
Ooh, sepsis is a good one. Sepsis is just an infection of the bloodstream. So in contrast to a lot of these infections where we talk about a particular bacteria or a virus, you know, we'll say MRSA or we'll say influenza, sepsis is a broad category that captures all of this. So any bacterial infection in the bloodstream we call sepsis. And that's a really dangerous condition because it can cause your blood pressure to drop and you can die very quickly. At the hospital where I work, half of the admissions to the intensive care unit are patients with sepsis. So we have a whole protocol that we follow when we identify a patient with sepsis that we have proven will save lives and will improve care. But the key is to diagnose it quickly. And it can be sometimes a tricky thing to find out that somebody has a bacterium in their blood. And you have to have a specific types of blood tests and other types of tests. But if you diagnose it quickly, you can treat it appropriately. But a lot of times it gets missed.
With these antibiotics that basically are not any good anymore, I mean, like tetracycline and things like that, are they passe or do they still have some power to it?
Well, I tell you, I start my book with me having to treat a patient with a superbug infection with an antibiotic called colistin. And colistin was a drug that fell out of favor 30 years ago because it was so outrageously toxic. But we're reaching to drugs like colistin again because many of the antibiotics that we've relied upon are no longer working. And we're trying to find drugs that still work. And for better or worse, we're reaching for drugs like colistin, which can chew up the kidneys, it can affect your brain, it has all kinds of side effects, but it actually works as an antibiotic. And so some of the conversations I have with patients are saying, you have a severe infection and we've got to use a pretty harsh drug I'm going to get you through this, but it's not going to be easy. And what I wanted to call attention to is how important it is for us to make new antibiotics and why that's such a challenge now. And in fact, the pharmaceutical companies are increasingly saying we don't want to make antibiotics.
Interesting. Tell us how they do that. We're going to take a quick break. Dr. Matt McCarthy with us. His book is called Superbugs. His website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Dr. Matt McCarthy with us, of course. We're talking about his latest work, Superbugs. Matt, you were talking about how some pharmaceutical companies are a little hesitant in trying to develop further any antibiotics. If that's the case, what happens? Do these superbugs run rampant?
Well, this is the most important medical issue that no one is talking about. We have relied on the pharmaceutical industry for the past 75 years to make antibiotics, and they have recently decided collectively that they're not making enough money off of these drugs and are choosing to do other things. And I'll tell you why. Imagine a blood pressure drug. A doctor prescribes it to a patient and says, take it every day for the rest of your life. That's a good business model. Think about an antibiotic. They're only prescribed in short courses. Doctors are stingy about doling them out. And even the best new drug eventually wears itself out when the bacteria mutate. So it's a really thin profit margin for a pharmaceutical company. And increasingly, they're saying, you know what? The money's just not there. It's too risky. It takes about $1 billion and 10 years of studies to bring any new discovery from the laboratory to patients. We're not going to do it. And one of the most important political issues that no one's talking about are there are a number of proposals on the table to entice these pharmaceutical companies to start making antibiotics again. And that's what I wanted to get readers to understand, is that you're going to be hearing politicians come forward with proposals to sweeten the deal for pharmaceutical companies.
Yep.
And I want people to know what's a good idea and what's a bad idea.
In your career, what has been one of the worst infections you've had to deal with? Because you're an infectious disease specialist.
Yes, yes. Well, the one that they tell you to never Google, and so I'll just give you that warning, is something called Fournier's gangrene. F-O-U-R-N-I-E-R, Fournier's gangrene, which is a flesh-eating infection of the scrotum the groin area. I typically see that.
No, don't Google that.
Yeah, don't trust me. But it's a patient who has poorly controlled diabetes, which can weaken your immune system. Somebody may try to pop a zit or pop a pimple in their groin area, and it allows the bacteria to get under the skin. And it rapidly spreads, and it can be something that can only be cured not with antibiotics, but with surgery.
Oh, my God.
It's one of the most distressing things you can see as a clinician and as a patient. It's shocking.
Neosporin won't work, huh?
No. And that's why it's so important for us to have new treatment options available, because I spend my days, I walk in the hospital, and the first thing I do is I see patients who are suffering from infections. So this is what I spend my time thinking about. How are we going to do a better job with these patients?
Well, we take calls next hour with Matt McCarthy. One, we'll take your questions, obviously. But if you have had some kind of infection, jump aboard and let's talk about it. Don't be shy either. We'll get some thoughts on that. Do they experiment on people with these new formulas?
Yes. What I spend my time doing as a researcher is I do human experimentation. That I will take a drug that was discovered in a laboratory somewhere or found in the soil somewhere, and I will bring it into my hospital and I'll study it. And what I've really enjoyed writing about in my books is what it's like to try to do an experiment on a human being. And we have a number of safeguards in place to make sure that patients are protected and that a guy like me can't walk into the hospital with a dangerous drug. We have something called an Institutional Review Board, an IRB, that reviews any proposal for a study. Before anyone can do an experiment on you, it has to be approved by an IRB. And then if a doctor walks up to you and says, hey, I've got this new clinical trial, you might be a candidate for it. You don't have to join that. You can just say, no, thank you. And many patients do. But some are interested or intrigued. And, when it comes to clinical research, we're eager to get more volunteers. And people get paid a little bit for their participation, and that's a big part of how we bring drugs to market, is we have to test them on humans to make sure they're safe.
And I assume these people sign off on that in case something goes awry?
Yes, there is a lot of paperwork to be done for this. But this is the essence of how the FDA approves drugs, is we test them on in a test tube, and then we test them on animals, and then we test them on healthy human volunteers. And then lastly, we test them on patients who have the infection that we're studying. And if all of that goes well, it can be approved, the drug can be approved by the FDA. But that takes, as I said, close to $1 billion to get done. And companies don't want to risk it. They want to, you know, do a Botox or a blood pressure medication where they can make more money.
I've always been a believer in natural things if you can do it first. And I, you know, think that this planet has an incredible ability to create its own, you know, antidotes for things on the planet. And I mean, things like apple cider vinegar, they're good for infections and things like that. What do you think of just going natural?
Yeah, well, this is one of the coolest parts of doing the kind of work that I do, is we are always looking for new cures for infections. And a place that we're finding them is actually in the soil beneath our feet.
Yep.
And it turns out that bacteria in the soil are engaged in this molecular warfare where they are all producing these chemicals that they shoot out into the environment trying to kill all of the bacteria that are around them. And if we can harness those chemicals...
Bacteria trying to kill other bacteria?
That's exactly right. They're fighting each other. And the way they do it is they secrete chemicals. And if we can find those chemicals, we can turn them into medicines. And that's actually what a lot of scientists are trying to do now. They're sifting through the haystack of soil looking for new drugs that we can use to cure infections. And part of the next 25 years of science is going to be figuring out how to use artificial intelligence and big data so that people don't have to sift through the soil, and we can just go into the haystack and pull out that medication. And that's going to be the big challenge of medicine moving forward.
Are they successful in finding some of these possibilities?
Yeah, and you know, that's where our first antibiotic, penicillin, where that came from is there was a fungus that was just pumping out penicillin trying to kill the bacteria in its environment. And we've got scientists now who are very good at finding these new chemicals. The problem is when they find it, they need a pharmaceutical partner to help bring that to market. And they're having trouble finding companies that are willing to spend the money to do the clinical trials on animals and in humans to bring that incredible discovery to the patients who need it most.
You had written a piece called "Why Does the Flu Vaccine Suck This Year?"
Yes.
To put it bluntly, I have not gotten a flu vaccine in God, I don't know how long. I can't remember. And I haven't gotten the flu, knock on wood. What do you think of the vaccines?
Well, this is one of those conversations where every time I talk about vaccines with somebody, it's a little bit different. When a patient says to me, "Dr. McCarthy, what do you think of vaccines?" I typically say to them, "What do you think of vaccines?" And that opens a dialogue with people. But the piece that I wrote was about how every year for the flu vaccine, we have to guess which of the different serotypes we're going to put in our vaccine. And sometimes we guess wrong. And that year, I wrote about how we guessed wrong, and we made a pretty weak influenza vaccine. It still worked, but not as well as we would like. I am somebody who subscribes to the belief that that vaccines work. And the problem I'm seeing where I practice in New York is we have this measles outbreak where we have nearly 1,000 cases of measles, and it's because people aren't getting vaccinated. And what I've found is that there are two groups of people who aren't vaccinating. There are the anti-vaxxers, which are a well-described group. But there's also a group of people who say, "I believe the vaccine works. I just don't want to give it to my kid." And
exactly.
That's a group that hasn't been talked about very much. They say, "We believe it's safe. We believe it works, just not for my kid." And we haven't figured out a way to convey to these patients and these parents that it's a potentially dangerous thing to expose your kid to measles.
And let me ask you this too, Matt, because the parents who are pro-vaccine and everybody's entitled to their own views. But sure, the parents that are pro-vaccine go ballistic if their child is around a kid who hasn't been vaccinated. My question is, medically, if your kid has been vaccinated, why do you care who he's with? Because he should be immune, right?
Yes. If your kid has been vaccinated, then your kid's immune. There's a concept called herd immunity, which is that if everyone's vaccinated, the disease goes away. And we've lost this herd immunity. And so I think people get really worked up about this. The other group that I see getting really worked up are people who have babies who are less than 12 months old. So they haven't been able to vaccinate their baby yet because it's so young. And they get militant about it. There's no other way to describe it. You know, the work that I do is largely with antibiotics and not with vaccines. So I'm usually coming in trying to figure out how do I treat the infection after it's already occurred. And the vaccines are much more effective for preventing the infection. But, you know, this is a contentious topic. And you're right, I've written about how sometimes the vaccines that we try to design aren't as good as we would like them to be.
You're on the New York Presbyterian Hospital Ethics Committee. What do you folks look at?
Oh, this is one of the most fascinating jobs you could possibly have, which is that when doctors find that they're doing something that they don't feel comfortable with, or a patient thinks something is happening that doesn't seem right, they can ask an ethicist like me to come in and to produce a judgment of what's right and what's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And what's fascinating about that is that it's not always what's legal. So there are times where I'll say, well, legally you're allowed to do this. They would say to me, I'm not asking you for a legal opinion. I'm asking you for an ethical opinion. And I'll give you an example.
And let me ask you, in all due respect here, I mean nothing derogatory, but are you playing God when you do this?
Well, I'll give you an example and I'll let you decide.
All right.
A 12-year-old boy has liver cancer. And he needs to have his tumor removed. And the parents say, we don't want the tumor removed. We want to pray the tumor away.
Mm-hmm.
What should happen? And the surgeon says, I can cure this, but I need to operate on this child. And the family says, no. They turn to an ethicist and say, what do we do here? And what you have to take into account are all kinds of value judgments and legal precedents and trying to figure out what's a solution that's in the best interest of the child, but also, you know, respects the religious views of the family,
Sure. Make
sure that the surgeon is doing what's right. And sometimes, you feel like you're playing God. It's a really important and powerful position to be in.
See, the position I would have taken, I would have prayed that the operation went well.
Yes, exactly. You're exactly right. We got a seat for you on the ethics committee.
Absolutely. I think a blend of mainstream medicine and prayer and pharmacy and natural supplements, a combination of them, probably is the best way to do something.
I think you're probably right. And I'll tell you, I pray with patients. I talk to them about supplements. I talk to them about mainstream medicine. Clearly not, we don't have all the answers. And I think that it's good to have a blend of approaches.
This statistic I had before you came on, that 23,000 people die each year from antibiotic-resistant infections. Is that number going to go up or down?
That number is going to skyrocket.
Oh, boy.
In fact, the prediction from the World Health Organization is that by 2050, it's going to be 10 million people worldwide every year dying from superbugs.
Worldwide.
And yes, worldwide. And it's going to be a bigger issue than heart disease or cancer. And this is why I felt such urgency writing about superbugs, is because people don't really talk about it that much. They think about it or they'll get an article forwarded to them. But this is really important because at the time when we need new antibiotics, the companies that make them are getting out of the business. The pharmaceutical industry has decided that this market is broken. And one of the proposals that's on the table that you're going to be hearing about from politicians is something called a push incentive, where we can give tax breaks to the pharmaceutical industry if they promise to invest some of the excess profits into new antibiotics. Some people think that's a great idea. Some don't.
A friend of mine died in 2003. He was the St. Louis County executive. That's, like the mayor, but this was the county. And he came down with the meningitis. They put him in a self-induced coma. and he ended up dying of the infection. I mean, just horrible, horrible.
Yeah.
No way out on something like that. Is it just a roll of the dice or what?
In some ways it is. You know, one of the most useful things that listeners can do is to find out what their risk is for infection. And what I mean by that is having a simple conversation with your doctor and saying, how do you think my immune system is? Many of the patients that I see don't realize that they're on a medication that may subtly alter their immune system, or that they have a medical condition that weakens their immune system. You know, being on a drug like prednisone can weaken your immune system. Some people don't even know that. And just arming yourself with an understanding of where your body is a good starting point. And then you can start thinking about what are the bacteria and the fungi in your environment and how can you protect yourself?
Jeez, and let me ask you this, in terms of education for people, how important is it to wash your hands, clean up, things like that?
Crucial. What has been controversial in the medical world is how should you clean your hands? You know, these antibacterial soaps have fallen out of favor lately.
Yeah, why?
Well, because if there's an antibacterial drug in that soap, the bacteria will start evolving around it.
Really?
So soap and water is often the most useful thing that you can use.
How about just hot water without soap? Do you need soap?
Yeah, I like the soap. You know, it picks up a lot of the bacteria and it kind of helps them get off of your skin and your hands. And, you know, the FDA is recommending soap and water, and I think that's pretty wise. You know, really hot water is a good idea, too. I wash the dishes in my house and I get scalding water going because I think it makes it cleaner. So, you know, that's a good idea.
Bleach is not bad either.
Bleach works.
A little bleach here and there on your counters and stuff. Gosh, I had a story a couple weeks ago that was a warning by the FDA about chicken. And, you know, it definitely said do not wash your chicken in the sink because you're going to contaminate your sink worse than what it was.
I saw that, too. I nudged my wife and I said, you hear that? You know, the good news is that we're starting to hear more and more about the ways that we can protect ourselves. I don't want people to be fearful to think that, you know, that these super bugs are going to be, you know, coming for them in their homes and attacking them. And,
there's a movie there somewhere, Matt.
There is.
The super bug that ate New York or something. Hey, stay with us. We're going to come back. Let's take phone calls next. Questions for you, or if you have had some kind of infection, tell us how you battled back. If you did, we'll be back.